Well, let's take our seats, shall we? Yeah, he is, as a matter of fact. Did he show you these? These are some questions he suggested we might distribute to keep discussion going.
Oh, good. No, I haven't seen them.
I think we might as well just pass them around.
Are they up here?
No, he's got them. Where is he? Well, could I start could I begin by reminding you that that we are invited at noon when we adjourn at noon, John Buckelt, who is with the North Slope Borough, has invited us to come at noon to see the geographic information system. This is on display at their office here in Anchorage, and we can just walk over there. Orrin Young will and some of the folks from the borough will lead the way. So when we adjourn at lunch, if you'd like to go over there, we'll just go over with Orrin, and this is quite a remarkable display, I'm told. There's just one question that I forgot to ask John Buckelt. Do we drop into the cafeteria on the way to make sure we eat, or is it? Do you know anything about that, Orrin?
I would think we'd go over there first.
All right, we go over there first. Okay. Okay. Okay, so that's the program at noon. For those who are interested, is to go over to the borough office and see the geographic information system that I believe is quite remarkable, and I hope to go over myself to see it. Bishop DeRue had to leave today. But I know I speak for all of you in saying how much we appreciate his attendance and his remarks that I think made a real impact on all of us. Dennis Demert had to go back to Fairbanks today. He is the parliamentarian at the Doyon annual meeting, which is being held in Fairbanks today. And I think the rigors of that particular office exceed those of being a participant in the round table, and we wish him well. But Dennis said he will be back tomorrow morning to rejoin us. I should say that Professor Hanke will likely be leaving for Fairbanks tomorrow and won't be with us tomorrow, so I want on your behalf to thank him in advance for coming, and I know we will hear more from him today, but I do want to thank him before it gets lost in the general confusion of adjournment later today. And Clem Charchet has to leave tonight, and so Clem will not be with us tomorrow, and I want again to thank Clem in advance for his attendance here today. What we thought we would do today, Rosita and David and I had a chat about this, and with your approval, what I thought we would do would be something like this. First of all, one or two wanted to add a few words to the discussion that Bishop DeRue initiated yesterday. I think Bernie Nietzschman, there he is, and Sheldon Kachetag wanted to add a few words, and if anyone else does, by all means, just catch my eye, and you're more than welcome. What I thought we would then do is this. It seems to me that it would be worthwhile today examining the extent to which UN resolutions and the work of UN agencies and other international bodies has given rise to a clear definition or an unclear definition of the status of indigenous peoples under emerging international law. And so I was going to ask Bernie Nietzschman to begin that discussion, and I was going to ask Doug Sanders to follow it up and to tell us about the work of the International Court of Justice and to what extent its decisions, particularly the decision in the Western Sahara case, bear on this question. And then I was going to ask Sandy Davis to tell us about the work of the Organization of America, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, and the extent to which their work may bear on this. And then I was going to ask Clem Chartier and Henry Hsu to follow up after that. I only mention those names so that there is some organization to this thing, and of course everyone is welcome to pitch in. But I thought with your concurrence that we might proceed in that way. And then David Case has prepared a list of questions that seem to arise out of the discussion thus far, and we will be passing those around, and they may be, it may be that sometime this afternoon they will give us a basis for focusing the remainder of the discussion later today and tomorrow. It may be that others besides Professor Henke and Clem Chartier are leaving tonight and won't be here tomorrow, but we do plan to carry on tomorrow, even if the numbers are diminished. We think it is that we are fortunate in having you here, and we would like to carry on. And indeed, every roundtable thus far that has scheduled meetings on Saturday morning, they have been well attended, sometimes to my astonishment. But so we will plan on a Saturday meeting, and Dennis will be back from Fairbanks for that. And David, during the course of the day, will just pass his questions around. So I thought that might be a good way of using our time today, and so if you don't mind, we'll proceed along those lines. And Bernie Nietzschman, you wanted to explore this vein that was opened by Bishop DeRue yesterday, I think, and call on you, and then Sheldon, and then anyone else who'd like to say something on that before we turn to international law.
One of the things I wanted to comment on that the bishop had mentioned is he made a comment about oppressed peoples will survive or vanish depending on how clearly they understand who they are. And this, what he's talking about is cultural resistance. And it's something that we often hear too little about. We hear a great deal about cultural change, but very little about peoples who persist, societies that persist, and the role of identity as a means of resistance to impose change. And what struck me about this is actually a very personal event that happened when I encountered people at another round table. The round table was in a rainforest, in a place that you go without having to get a visa. And Indian warriors and Indian leaders were sitting down discussing the works of Amilcar Cabral. Cabral was the Secretary General of the Guinea-Bissau Liberation Movement that eventually freed that country from Portuguese colonization. And Cabral was one of the world's outstanding political theoreticians and practitioners of those theories. And what the Miskito warriors were in fact discussing was Cabral's comments on the power of culture as a means of resistance. And they were reading a piece that Cabral had delivered at Syracuse University in 1970 called National Liberation and Culture. And I jotted down a few excerpts from that, which I felt was significant at the time, and I still do. It's from a book called Return to the Source. And Cabral wrote, "To take up arms to dominate a people is above all to take up arms to destroy, or at least to neutralize, to paralyze its cultural life. For with a strong indigenous cultural life, foreign domination cannot be sure of its perpetuation. At any moment, depending on internal or external factors, cultural resistance, indestructible, may take on new forms, political, economic, armed, in order to fully contest foreign domination. The ideal for foreign domination, whether imperialist or not, would be to choose." And here Cabral outlined the dilemma of the foreign colonialist. "One, either to liquidate practically all the population of the dominated country, thereby eliminating the possibilities for cultural resistance, or two, to succeed in imposing itself without damage to the culture of the dominated people, that is, to harmonize economic and political domination of these people with their culture and personality. The first hypothesis implies genocide and ethnocide. The second hypothesis has not yet been confirmed by history." The response of one of the Miskito leaders to that was more to the point when he said, "Our people and our land are the same, and our culture is our resistance. And for centuries, people have tried to change that, but they won't. We still are here, we still have our language, our land, and our identity, and that won't change." And I thought this was appropriate not only at that time, but to bring up the idea that the bishop was expressing in terms of colonialism and culture as a form of a resistance. And I wanted to simply emphasize that to the bishop, and now I find myself in his seat, and it's a bit awkward, but that was what I wanted to say.
Sheldon.
Thank you, Justice Berger. First of all, I'm pretty much trying to get myself organized as to what I had intended to say yesterday evening when the iron was hot. One of the things
it's a shame
that
we missed it then.
Well, no, it's not a shame because you didn't miss it. It just takes a few seconds for me to get organized. One of the things that we must realize about this, the native situation here in Alaska, is that it is the most obvious Uh, effect of the policies of the federal government with regard to indigenous people. And I think what we have to realize is that the federal government is playing both sides of the fence at the same time. Now, what I mean by this is that they are attempting, on the one hand, to appease Alaska's natives and their demands for fulfillment of all their rights, and on the other hand, they are trying to prove to the people of America that what they did was not wrong. Now, that creates a problem for them because they're going to have to end up lying to both sides. Now, a parallel, I think, has to be made between the actions of the United States of America and that of another Western society, that being United Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Recently in the paper, there was a news article which stated that the Russian government was taking some 100,000 village children from Afghanistan and relocating them to Russia. And the purpose for this relocation was a very noble cause of education. And their premise was that the facilities were not available, the instructors were not available to provide this education for these Afghani children in Afghanistan. So as a result, we now see that the Russians are taking 100,000 children not to be educated, but to be programmed to think a certain way. Is that not what education is? Development of thought processes. Now, we can call it indoctrination, we can call it anything we want, but I think we would all agree that this kind of behavior of a dominant culture over a subordinate culture is reprehensible. 100,000 children being removed from their villages, taken across international boundaries for the purpose of education. In the last 50 years, I think most Alaska Natives would agree with me when they say that a similar action was taken, not by the Russians, but by the Americans with regard to Alaska's natives. And in reading some of the things that I've gone through, I think that has taken place to a less greater extent in Canada. In our case, our children were taken from their villages, some as young as 5 and 6 years old. And depending on the ease with which it could be done, in other words, the ease with which they could convince the parents that this was necessary, they met with varying degrees of resistance. So that in some communities, children were taken as young as 5 and 6 years old, whereas in other communities, they were required to provide the first through the eighth grades, and then from the ninth to the 12th grades, they were taken out of the community. What was the purpose of this? Education. Now, we have seen the product of this education. We have had these leaders, which I would like to call at this time, due to the parallel, these are Afghani Alaska Natives, because they have been indoctrinated. They have been reprogrammed so that they do not think in the tribal sense. They do not know their responsibility to their tribe. And they only know the values of the education system through which they went through. And I think that is very evident when you look at the way things are now. The way has been paved for these Afghani Alaska Natives to re-enter Alaska and to assume positions of leadership with the blessings of the federal government. We have lettered these people. We have taken them to our institutions and allowed them, after a certain period of indoctrination, to carry letters after their name. John Q. Eskimo, BS. We all know what that means. And I think that all of our Native people should realize that this has happened, including these so-called Afghani Alaska Natives, that they have been reprogrammed. And my position by saying this is that the press has made this issue, this Alaska Native issue, ANCSA, sovereignty, self-determination, local control, all of these things, they have made this a polarizing issue. As chairman of the United Tribes of Alaska, that is not my function. My function, as outlined in our charter, is to unite our people and to inform them of their first responsibility to their tribe. And I think it's important that our people realize this. And I would hope that these Afghani Alaska Natives would look at their situation and try to understand who they are. Not just by the color of their skin, not just by the color of their hair, and not just by who their mother or father happened to be. They must now, I think, in interest of not only helping themselves, but helping our people, they must look at their actions and take this perspective, not from their individual perspectives as these Afghani Alaska Native leaders, but look at it from the position of the Alaska Native most impacted by their actions, the village Alaska Native, that vast majority out in the middle of nowhere who cannot make his feelings known. Where do we go from there? We have to have an education campaign. We have to have an information campaign. In effect, we have to reprogram these leaders. Not against their will. That's not our way. We give them every opportunity to look at the facts of the matter, and we would hope they would make an informed decision. That is all that we ask. Now, this particular roundtable is aimed at the future. What is the place of Alaska's natives in particular, and natives in general around the world, or in this case, in the Americas, in the Western world. I have just been handed a news release that came off the Associated Press, which is entitled "Agency Backs Indians' Rights to Tax Oil Leases on Tribal Land." What does this say? Associated Press, Dateline, Washington. The Reagan administration urged the Supreme Court on Monday to allow Indian tribes to tax mining and oil and gas leases on tribal land without federal approval. In a case involving Navajo lands in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, the Justice Department said that the court should uphold a ruling that the Secretary of the Interior is not required to review Indian taxing authority. Congress permitted the Interior Secretary to supervise Indian land management but did not mandate it, said government lawyer Lewis F. Claiborne. He added that a substantial number of other tribes are amending their constitution to permit them to impose taxes without federal approval. The Navajo tax is being challenged by Kerr McGee Corporation to avoid paying a levy on uranium, oil, and gas leases the company has on tribal land. Alvin H. Schrago of Phoenix, Arizona, a lawyer for the corporation, said that for 50 years, and this is important, most tribes have assumed federal law requires them to get approval from the Interior Secretary before enacting taxes on non-Indians. The administration's current position is encouraging tribes to revoke their constitutions to eliminate the requirement for federal approval of tribal taxes. Elizabeth Bernstein, an attorney for Window Rock, Arizona, representing the Navajos, said the tribes enacted the taxes because it is badly in need of funds for essential services on the reservation. So there's the word from the horse's mouth on an option for Alaska's native people. But they can't do it as corporations. Corporations cannot tax. They are not governments. They are business entities. And that is a point that I have been trying to make all along. As we get into the basis for this, by the way, comes from, I believe it's the 97th Congress, second session. A particular act which says, Title II, Tax Status of Indian Tribal Governments. This title may be cited as the Indian Tribal Government Tax Status Act of 1982. There is a whole raft. We also have a Federal Register, Department of the Treasury, Temporary Procedural and Administrative Tax Regulations, Indian tribal governments treated as states for certain purposes, including taxes and bonds, by the way. We also have a procedure here, part of 25 U.S.C. subsection 443, Revenue Procedure 8387, which outlines how tribal governments can comply and take advantage of this law. And we also have, under Revenue Procedure 8387, a list of tribal governments across the states, and in the very back, we have a list of Alaska Native entities recognized by the IRS, the Congress, Federal Register, and the Treasury Department as having this ability not only to tax but to sell bonds. There are certain restrictions as usual, But you will see that there are a large number of villages all the way from Akiak to Wrangell that have this authority. And they include such tiny places as Craig Community Association, Grayling, Heidelberg, Beaver, Ambler, Kiana, Klawak, Stebbins, and so on. Now, this has great implications, I think, for the direction that this particular group should take with regard to what is the place of Native people in the Western world, and particular, what is the place of Alaska's Natives in our world, however Western it may be. And this brings us around to that most important, at least from my perspective, because it relates to everything that I am and that I do, and that is my source of livelihood. Now, I have here another clarification which I think will be invaluable to our discussion here, because it clarifies this means of getting a livelihood. The word subsistence is meaningless if left standing alone. If used as an adjective in defining an economic system, then the term subsistence economic system makes sense. It is now necessary to define economic system so that there is no erroneous preconceived idea of what we are talking about. What I mean by an economic system is the most efficient, organized production and distribution of goods and services to people so that people can subsist off the resources available to them. The basis of subsistence economic systems is centered around the individual. As he integrates his efforts to subsist off the resources with other individuals into an organized family unit, he arrives at the first civilized cooperative interrelationship called a family subsistence economics system. The next level of organization integrates the family system into a village subsistence economic system. The increased access to goods and services thus available through organization results in expanded trade of surplus to a greater community. And this then, you can get into a region, you can get into continental subsistence economic systems if you wish. But I believe it's important that as far as our people are concerned, that we concentrate our efforts on developing the village and the regional subsistence economics system. The state of Alaska, the Supreme Court recently ruled that subsistence is a right of all people and that it must not be discriminated by law. That's all well and good. We all have to eat. But the state subsistence law as enacted in 1978 and the federal subsistence laws as enacted in ANILCA Title 8 all say the same thing. But these laws are not being enforced. They say that there is a certain priority that must be recognized if in fact you are going to be limiting subsistence activities. And all of these laws say that Native people, due to their dependence on this subsistence economic system, are entitled to the last chance at that resource before it is cut off from everybody in the interest of making this these resources, whichever resources are under pressure, renewable, reasonable. There's nothing ambiguous about the law. It's well written, I think. But the point is, these laws are not being enacted. They are not being enforced. And I think that in order for our people to ensure, number one, that the federal government's subsistence laws and the state of Alaska's subsistence laws are enforced, and this is a recommendation, by the way, from the resource specialist subsistence for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, that the tribal governments, since they in effect will be the last priority users, that they in fact should regulate subsistence. Why do we have to have second and third party brokers when we are developing a means to provide for our own livelihood? That Alaska's native people do not require that the citizens of the United States abide by their regulations with regard to subsistence economic activities. I think the United States would be a lot better off if they did, but that's neither here nor there. And I think even though we have proved down to the centuries that we have developed a workable subsistence economic system, community by community, that we have been needlessly regulated by external forces. And I think these tribal governments would be the most valuable tool for our people to in fact regulate their subsistence. I'm sure we as Native people would be more than willing to abide by regulations that we develop ourselves and enforce ourselves than those which are imposed upon us from the outside. Is that not what this is all about? Alaska's Native people want to be able to control their own lives. And what is more important to life than the food you eat? You are what you eat. And Bishop Daru yesterday was speaking to the Bible's precept of stewardship. And I would contend here that Alaska's native cultures are the highest examples of harmonious, responsible stewardship of the land and its resources, because we have been doing it for thousands of years. The point has been made with regard to ANCSA during all those months of testimony, that what evidence is there that Alaska's native people have been here for thousands of years? I'm glad they developed archaeologists, because they didn't believe us when we said we were here for thousands of years. They said, "Where's your Captain Cook? Where's your Sheffield Hotel? Where is your federal building?" What you must realize is that these things are sitting on very useful land as far as we're concerned. Our cultures have developed a way of living,
with our environment that is non-destructible, self-renewing, and harmonious. And if, in fact, these activities must be regulated, I think it's the native people's right to regulate their own subsistence. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheldon. Rosita?
May I just expand on Sheldon's earlier remarks about the removal of children from their homes, native children from their homes, and the potential that it holds for cultural genocide through the removal of its future members. A study by Carrie Feldman and other anthropologists a couple of years ago, and this was after the passage of the Indian Child Welfare Act that supposedly was enacted to decrease the rate of removal of Indian children from their home. This study showed that Alaska Native children were being removed from their homes at three times the rate as non-Native children, and placed in various institutional care, education, health, and some of the correctional institutions. And there, we have no studies on the removal of children from single mothers, you know, at right after birth. But we have some unconfirmed reports about suggesting that the removal is extensive. And one unconfirmed report right after the enrollment indicated that there were some 800 Alaska Native children placed in homes in northeastern area, where Indianist societies are very prominent. There are communities in New England that I guess they have a fetish about having Indian children, and I myself.
These are white families.
Yes, white families. It's their Indianist societies, and I attended one of their functions in a community in New Hampshire when I was back east, and they actually have these community days where they play Indians, and they have all of these Indian children. As I said, this is unconfirmed reports that we had there after the enrollment. There were 800 children, but it was traced back to the adoption from the Native hospital, where mothers were pressured by different religious orders to give up children who were illegitimate. And of course, the concept of a fatherless child is an alien concept to Alaska Native societies. We have always had single mothers, and children have always been placed with extended family members. So the removal, it appears, is continuing, and probably even at a greater rate than we know.
Oren, you wanted to say something, and then Rena.
Yes, I wanted to make just a couple of clarifying remarks on the content of the existing subsistence provisions, particularly in Title 8 of ANILCA. One thing that's very explicit in the provisions of Title 8 of ANILCA is that the subsistence regime that it sets up is not in any way based on a native, non-native distinction. It's fundamentally based on a rural, non-rural distinction. Now, Title 8 of ANILCA may be a good law and it may be a very bad law, but it is certainly not a law which has anything to do with recognizing, much less promoting, a special place for indigenous people in society, unlike the place of any other recognized minority. To come back to a question that
right.
Tom raised at the very beginning of this roundtable, which I think is really one of the fundamental issues that we all need to address. Is there, should there be, can there be a place for native peoples, indigenous peoples, unlike the place of any other minority in society. ANILCA Title VIII is a legal regime which cuts directly in the other way from that. And so if you really, it doesn't suggest any opposition to rural subsistence users, including natives, playing a significant part in the decision-making process. That's not the problem. The problem is it rests on a very direct fundamental proposition that runs counter to the idea that there should be a special place unlike that of any others. And so if one really wants to promote that goal, which I think is a very interesting goal, one has to attack ANILCA root and branch.
Yes, Oren, might I intervene at this point? I think that your point is a vital one. And indeed, we had a round table in October on subsistence for 4 days and discussed the current Alaska subsistence regime at length. That has been thrown into some confusion by the recent judgment of the Supreme Court of Alaska, and that's something that the Commission will have to deal with in due course. I don't want us to be sidetracked onto a discussion of subsistence because we've been through that. It's in my mind and in all our minds, but I think what I'd like to do is, Rena wanted to say something arising out of the earlier discussion, and I was going to ask Oscar or Verna if they wish to as well, since there may be two views about the purport of Sheldon's earlier remarks relating to schools and so on. But what I wanted to do after that was to turn to the place of Native peoples in the Western world. Does we know what the U.S. Constitution says? We know what Alaska law says. We've studied.